Good morning. My name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the new president of NAGARA and also the State Archivist of Oregon. And we'd like to welcome you here to our final morning plenary session, and we've been treated to two wonderful sessions so far, and this promises to be just as good. And before we get started, there's a little bit of business that we need to do for NAGARA. A number of people have won prizes, but they've yet to come by to pick them up. So the following people need to stop by the NAGARA booth to get their prize: Margaret Anderson, Conley Edwards, Gail Ralph, Tony Adams, Jessica Potter, Leslie Anderson, Carla Ash, Juanita Castilla, Nancy Ostertag, Sarah Gann, Cheryl Stadel-Behrens, Shelley Thompson, Amy Felker, and Brian Grizzell. So if you go by the NAGARA booth, your prizes are awaiting you. So the title of this morning's session is Disaster Preparedness and Recovery. For many of us, this is a daunting topic, overwhelming, not knowing where to begin and what to do. In many cases, that equates to doing nothing and hoping that we will never be tested by these sudden and unexpected events. For example, in 1996, the Willamette Valley in Oregon experienced the 100-year flood. Many state and local government agencies were affected. The agriculture building, which is the building just south of the archives building, was completely destroyed when the little creek next door came rushing through into the building and taking with it many of the department's electronic and paper records. Just across the street at the employment building, many of the state's data backup tapes sat in a combination of creek, ground, and sewer water for hours as the building's basement flooded. However, the destruction caused by this 100-year flood pales in comparison to what our two speakers experienced last summer as Hurricane Katrina took direct aim on the Gulf Coast. Their experiences are rich and the lessons learned invaluable. It is our hope that you will walk away today with a better understanding of what we as archivists and records managers need to do to prepare for any level disaster, whether it be an overflowing toilet, a 100-year flood, a computer system crash, or the millions of records lost to a devastating hurricane like Katrina. Now let me introduce to you our two speakers. First is Dr. Alan Weinstein, Archivist of the United States, a man many of us have gotten to know much better this past week, as he has spent many hours meeting formally and informally with us, taking the time to talk with us about the many issues currently facing us in our institutions. He has been a great supporter of all three organizations hosting this conference, NAGARA, COSA, and SAA. He has been a professor of history, is a writer of history, and most importantly, is a supporter of the records that document our history. In addition, he has been rewarded and recognized for these efforts, receiving numerous national and international awards and honors. Our second speaker is Hank Holmes, director of the Mississippi Department of Archives and History. He has been a frequenter of all three organizations, serving in a variety of capacities. In addition, he has taught classes on archival practices at Southern Mississippi and currently chairs or serves on a number of state and local commissions. So now it is time to sit back and listen to these two gentlemen and their lessons learned. Dr. Weinstein, I turn the podium over to you.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can't hear you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Look, if I've got to wake up, you've got to wake up. Before turning to a very serious topic, I would like to express my personal appreciation, I think you probably want to join me, for all of those who were responsible for that extraordinary reception at the Museum of American History yesterday. Thank you very much for all of you. And I want to tell you that it is an honor for me to be on this platform with my colleagues here, but with all due respect, Mary Beth, with one of the heroes of last year, Hank Holmes. This is an up-close and personal subject for me. I shall go to my grave remembering that extraordinary few days, those extraordinary few days, in which the most unlikely SWAT team on records repair you've ever could ever imagine got together to drive through rural Mississippi and Louisiana. There's Preston Huff, who was a member. I don't think Doris Hamburg is here today, but she was part of that. Hank Holmes was, of course, our leader. Carl Niederer was, where's Carl? Is he here somewhere? Anyway, Carl Niederer was with us. And we conducted the most extraordinary dialogue on archives and archival issues imaginable, locked in this tiny car for several days. It was quite an experience. Thank you for inviting me here today to share some thoughts on disaster preparedness and recovery. This is an area in which the National Archives has had some recent experience, as you may know. The lower levels of our historic building on the National Mall were flooded during the downpours of late June, and we closed the entire building to staff, to public, for more than 3 weeks while we worked to repair the extensive damage and restore electrical power. I want to emphasize, however, that there was no water damage to any records at the National Archives building, none whatsoever. But during that same period at the Washington National Record Center in Suitland, Maryland, a water pipe broke, spilling up to 4 to 5 inches of water on the floor and causing some 15,000 boxes of records to get wet, which we have, of course, all been taken care of. Fortunately, in both cases, our dedicated staff was quick to act, and we were well on the road to recovery from both situations. In fact, I could tell stories here. I will tell only one. I will not mention the gentleman's name, but he's one of our key facilitators at the archives. And at 2 in the morning, when the phone call came that the flood was racing through the basement, this remarkable man looked at his house, which was also being flooded at the same time, took a final look at his wife before she tried to beat his brains out, and walked out the door and came to work. So that by the time this archivist got to the archives, earlier than even I'd ever been there, we had a whole team working to get the water out, to pump the water out and to begin the process of dehumidification with outside folks coming in, wonderful contractors, particularly the gentleman who came from this firm who approached me and said, "I don't want you to worry, Professor, because we're on the case. This was about 7 in the morning, and everything is really being taken care of. And as for the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, please don't worry. They're dry, and they're in the back of my car." Just what I needed to hear. Today, however, I want to talk to you about larger disasters, those that affect millions of individuals in every aspect of their lives. When Hurricanes Katrina and Rita swept over the Gulf states of Louisiana, Texas, and Mississippi last year, millions of Americans living in those areas were left without many of the things they'd taken for granted. They lost loved ones, they lost homes, they lost businesses, they lost jobs. They faced life without police protection, without medical care, without public services, without retail stores, automobiles, access to their money, the basic things we assume we need to live from day to day. As if that wasn't enough, people also faced what I've been calling identity loss. Loss of vital records, property deeds, birth certificates, personal papers, as well as records that document their rights as Americans and their entitlement to government benefits. These had all been swept away in the path of the hurricane, and many were missing or heavily damaged or inaccessible. These kinds of records are crucial to the recovery and rebuilding process for governments, for institutions, for people, for families. And as a result, many in the path of the hurricanes were hard-pressed to provide basic documentation of their own identities in order to receive, among other things, the government benefits that were being rushed to the region. Also affected by the hurricanes were records of the routine operations of the federal government, the actions of regional offices, of departments, agencies, federal courts in these areas, as well as records of state and local governments. The National Archives and Records Administration, working closely with state archivists and with local archivists, stepped in to help assess, recover, and preserve these irreplaceable vital records. These are some of the things we did. At the Federal Register, editors stopped, which we produce every day, as most of you know, editors stopped the presses to add an important Treasury Department ruling that allowed financial institutions to cash government assistance checks for hurricane victims without requiring identification, which in many cases had been lost. This action was absolutely critical for a number of Americans because the rule was not in effect. You couldn't get your money until it was published in the Federal Register. Some NARA staff members spent weeks after the hurricanes working with federal agencies and our partners in state and local government to begin to identify and to recover records. NARA conservators held training sessions and workshops, also in collaboration with state and local archivists, training sessions for various federal and state officials and others who were dealing with damaged or contaminated documents. At FEMA's request, NARA conservators assisted in rescuing the records from the offices of officials in Orleans Parish, Louisiana, the heart of the hurricane's devastating damage. Floodwaters rose there up to 7 feet and greater than that. We supervised the transfer of these incredibly wet records to freezer trucks, which were taken to a facility in New York State. Once they were dry, they were evaluated, they were returned to Orleans Parish. Recovery of information on water-damaged computer hard drives was done also to the extent possible. NARA authorized federal agencies to destroy contaminated records that represented a risk to health, life, or property in which they had a temporary disposition of 10 years or less, and if the information in them, hopefully, was captured, at least in part, in other sources. The National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis expedited hurricane-related requests from veterans and retired civil servants who needed documents from their personnel files so they could establish or reestablish their own identities, again, the identity issue, thus qualifying them for government benefits. We created a special section also on our website, archives.gov, to deal with records recovery issues resulting from hurricane damage. The website listed agency contacts and provided links to information on records recovery and preservation for federal agencies and courts, state and local governments, cultural institutions, and the general public. Let me say a word about that. When we all began this process, and I think Hank would agree with me, and others who took part in this, Preston and others, we didn't know how to get in touch with one another. We didn't have the basics. We did not have the basic information that allowed us to basically put together teams of people that were in a position to be effective in response to this emergency. That is in the process of being corrected as we talk. The National Archives also worked closely with the appropriate federal authorities to secure representation on teams of federal officials that evaluate damaged buildings to determine the nature of records damage and what type of assistance from NARA will be needed. Because we also have a professional responsibility to ensure the preservation of non-federal historical documents that tell the story of America, I took several actions in my capacity as chairman of NARA's National Historic Records and Publications Commission. By the way, as long as I'm archivist of the United States, there will be a continued effort to persuade those who don't understand the importance of NHPRC, of the importance of NHPRC. That doesn't go away. That stays here. So, for example, we gave emergency grants of up to $25,000 from the NHPRC, authorized for the state archivists in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi for disaster assessment and response activities. Well, what lessons did we learn from our activities during the hurricane, after the hurricanes? First, we learned that much of our previous planning was focused on buildings, but the hurricanes made us think about a much wider scope of disaster planning. And we're now considering ways to respond more effectively to multiple concurrent emergencies that may cover larger geographic areas. Second, we also learned that the National Response Plan, which governs how the federal government responds to natural disasters, is silent on records. Although it mentions historic buildings, it mentions archaeological sites, we want to make recovery of records, both vital and historic records, an integral, critical, central part of this plan, and we will. But the fact is, it's not there yet. And we're doing more than that. We're seeking to institutionalize some of the things we did following Hurricanes Katrina and Rita along the Gulf Coast last year. There's a vacuum here that we need to fill, all of us. And so we're seeking a role as first preservers. Now, that's not first responders, but first preservers. To begin with, we've embedded the mission of first preservation into the strategic plan that will guide this agency for the next 10 years until 2017. And the plan states simply, we will be first preservers at NARA, promoting preservation of government records during times of disaster. Now, let me repeat that, because if you listen closely, you'll discover it doesn't say federal records, it says government records. As first preserver, we will support other government agencies and public institutions with advice about disaster preparedness for records. And during emergencies, we will provide counsel in reacting to situations that threaten records, but always, always in collaboration with other archivists at all levels of the archival profession. We will preserve the Federal Register publication system. It generates legal records essential to the continuity of American constitutional democracy. And we will ensure that the Federal Register will be published and will publish in times of crises in the face of all hazards for as long as needed. We seek to become a key partner in the federal response community, the agencies that have taken the lead in recovery after natural disasters under the National Response Plan. This team already includes FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, the Office of Personnel Management, the General Services Administration, and state and local emergency management agencies and officials. We have a role to play, and we intend to play it there. We believe we need to be present in planning the federal government's disaster response process as well as in evaluating damaged buildings to determine the nature of records damage so we can best determine the type of help that we need to provide. And we will support government agencies and public institutions with advice about disaster preparedness for records before emergencies occur. When there are emergencies, we will react to situations that threaten records, and our expertise will be available when there's a need to assist in the determination of records recovery methods and to assist in rapid contracting for response. A few more things before I finish. We're also progressing in our partnership with the Council of State Archivists for coordinated disaster planning and records recovery for state and local government records and for historical records in each of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. State-level emergency preparations are underway, and they will enhance communications and coordination of records with key agencies at the local, state, and federal level, including FEMA, Homeland Security, and other agencies. The aim is to ensure that no necessary or vital government and historic documents are lost through lack of preparedness for quick response and recovery. We're hoping that by the end of calendar year 2007, there will be 50 state archives that are better prepared to preserve their records with some help from us. And let me tell you that this seems like motherhood. It seems like a no-brainer, but it isn't. It's got to be fought for. It's got to be advocated. It's got to be pursued. What's the line that I used yesterday? How many archivists does it take to change a policy? It takes everybody in this room, and then some. So in conclusion, let me simply say that planning for something you hope will never occur is not in the 21st century a task that can be put off. Disaster preparedness is now imperative, and the National Archives will do its part with your help, as steward of the records that document our rights as citizens, the actions of our government, and the national experience. And I thank you for your attention.
Let me also say good morning. From my fellow archivists in Mississippi, I bring you greetings. I also bring you heartfelt thanks for all your cards and letters and offers of support during the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. I have been asked to address our response in the aftermath, and I will do so with the aid of some images, if I can multitask this morning. Following the 28th of August 2006, the entire length of the Mississippi Gulf Coast was devastated. For 100 miles, up to four blocks inland, every structure had either been washed away or so severely damaged that adverse impact would recommend demolition. Further inland, abundant damage also occurred as storm surges as high as 24 feet were experienced 6 miles inland. Contained in this area of damage were libraries, courthouses, historical societies, churches, and, of course, private homes. For many citizens and for some communities, the archival record abruptly disappeared. Katrina is frequently referred to as this country's greatest natural disaster so far. Certainly for Mississippi, it was the greatest natural disaster so far. Not only the Gulf Coast, but also a huge area of inland Mississippi felt the wrath of Katrina as she tore through the state, leaving roads impassable from flooding and falling trees, whole communities without power for weeks, and fractured communications. This widespread destruction presented response challenges never before encountered. Primarily, there was the tremendous challenge to the first responders to save human lives. There was also the enormous task of rebuilding the power transmission infrastructure and returning electricity to homes and businesses. The opening up of roads and highways for emergency use was a distinct challenge for such a large area. Above all of these was the challenge each affected individual encountered as the reality began to sink in that the whole world had changed. And in the middle of all of that was the challenge of securing the vital records of the communities so that they would be available once the community could begin its rebuilding process. On Labor Day, a week following the hurricane's landfall, department staff made their first foray to the Gulf Coast. There was still no power, there was no gas, and only intermittent cell phone service. There was no place to sleep, and there was no place to eat. First responders were far from finishing their work when we got a call from the governor's office that he would make arrangements for us to go down to Beauvoir to retrieve the archives. Beauvoir, a surviving symbol of the Confederate States of America for some folks, is now for the Gulf Coast a symbol of survival. One of only a handful of structures remaining on the 100-mile stretch of beachfront, this 154-year-old structure yet stands. For weeks after Katrina, the first question asked me from callers outside the state was, how is Beauvoir? While the Jefferson Davis Presidential Library and Museum building remains, albeit with the entire first floor swept away, the structure's survival is questionable. All exhibits washed out into the 50 acres of grounds and beyond. The library and archives were located on the second floor. Amazingly, the storm surge reached only to the top of the first floor, and very little water damage was found on the second floor. The staff had prepared well for the storm, covering everything in plastic to protect from leaking or non-existent roofs. Unfortunately, the water came from the other direction, 20 feet of it. We were retrieving the records from a very dark vault. As I said, there was no electricity. It's illuminated by the light of the flash. I will repeat this several times. There was no place to stay. There was no place to eat. There was little or no gas. It was a four-hour trip from Jackson to the coast, an 8 to 10 hour work day, and a four-hour trip back, packing in our own food and water. There was no store across town or on the other side of the county, for that matter, to which we could go when we ran out of supplies. In my current job, I serve as director of the Mississippi Department of Archives and History. My department is a comprehensive historical agency in that we administer the State Archives and Records Management Program, Local Government Records Office, the State Historical Museums and Sites, the National Register Program, and operate the State Historical Preservation Office. Suddenly, we found the resources of the entire department consumed in response to Katrina, as the damage directly involved each of our programs. Historic preservation staff were traveling each day to the coast to survey the damage to historic buildings. These folks were able to get into areas where residents had not been allowed to return to begin documentation of the structural damage. This was an activity that was to last intensely for many weeks. The museum staff made trips to determine the extent of damage to coast museums and in some cases to assist folks down there walking the grounds in the neighborhood looking for artifacts washed out by Katrina. The museum staff also had to deal with a catastrophe of their own back in Jackson. Within 30 minutes of arriving in Jackson, Katrina rolled up the copper roof of the old Capitol Restoration, a national historic landmark in the home of the State Historical Museum, and deposited it in the front lawn, allowing heavy rainfall to come in for 15 hours. The week following, a temporary roof was put in place only to be ripped off by Rita just a week later, allowing for even more rainfall to come in. Damage was so severe that the building had to be evacuated, staff, and all exhibits. Then there was the call for archivists to come for the need to do record salvage work. 3 weeks following Katrina, a call was received from the city clerk of Waveland, Mississippi. Even though downtown Waveland had vanished, including the city hall of which you see only the steps remaining, the ordinances and minutes of the town had survived. Shortly before Katrina arrived, the clerk had placed the volumes in the vault of the bank that stood next door to City Hall. She had wedged the volumes in so tightly that when they were inundated by the storm surge, the volumes had remained closed. Though the records were drenched, the pages were not soiled by the surge. Though the bank was gone, the vault remained standing. After we got the call, we were given directions to cross the railroad tracks and turn right on such and such a street. The railroad track was easy to find, but there were no longer any street signs. Not being familiar with the town, we were totally disoriented. We were aided by an Orange County, Florida sheriff's employee on duty in Hancock, Mississippi, who looked us up on his car's GPS and pointed the way. Though the records had survived in the bank vault, they had been removed from the vault and stored in an open-air trailer for a week before we got the call. In the heat and humidity, mold and mildew had had a field day. Some of these creatures, I think, could serve as an inspiration for Hollywood science fiction movies. When we arrived at Waveland, a fireman gave us heavy-duty plastic gloves and suggested we might want to wear them as the mold on the records might be dangerous. For future liability purposes, I made sure to park our van next to the health department van. In their coming and going, they never commented on us working with mold. However, the issue of mold became real. The internet and mass media were woefully full of dire stories about the effects of such concentrations of mold on the human body. In the mood of the recovery moment, apprehension reached such a level that some of the department staff became so scared they were balking at going into recovery. NARA came to our aid by sending two conservators down to hold a seminar on mold and on document drying options, and we also had the state epidemiologist to speak to that seminar. As a result, we all had a decent respect for mold, but fears had been sufficiently allayed that staff continued in their recovery work. It is important to take into consideration the power of the rumor factor. After fitfully cleaning the covers of the volumes, they were placed in our van, returned to Jackson, individually wrapped and frozen. At the other end of the coast in Jackson County, downtown Pascagoula suffered a storm surge of 16 feet. Many former commercial buildings in the area had been leased by the county for government office space, most of which was on the ground floor. As a result, Jackson County suffered the greatest damage to its government records. The department's local government records office had finished the inventory of records in the Jackson County Records Center only 6 days before Katrina hit. The Records Center was deemed a total loss, but we could provide the county with a detailed, up-to-date inventory of what they had lost. Fortunately, the county clerk had loaded up some of the county's important records, such as land records, onto a truck and removed them to higher ground before Katrina, and they survived undamaged. A disaster recovery company took custody of the records that could be salvaged. They are now being returned to the county, dried and cleaned. The current estimate by the company for the salvage of those records is $5 to $7 million. Toward the end of October, we received a call from the town of Pass Christian that clearance had finally been granted to enter their city hall. Up until this time, the building was considered too unsafe for entry, as it appeared it would fall down at any given moment. By the end of October, when it had not fallen down, like the old Mikey commercial, "Let the archivist go in." As a point of information, at the end of October, there was still little electricity in this area, and there were still no motel accommodations for 150 miles, but meals were available in the FEMA field tent. Pass Christian had experienced the highest recorded storm surge of Katrina, so we thought that our records recovery task at that late date would be of slight duration. To our surprise, we found the bound volumes of city ordinances and minutes, which had been stored in the vault, had indeed survived the flood and the onslaught of mold. Again, please note, despite the brightness of this photograph, it was pitch black in that vault. A few weeks earlier in Bay St. Louis, we were working in a similarly dank vault, that time up to our ankles in sludge, hearing creatures slithering around in the darkness. Also, please note in this picture, in this vault, the water came not from the sides, but from over the top. The mold had dried by this point, so cleaning was different. Also, by this time, thanks to the quick action of the archivist of the United States, and with all his help, and we came to finally refer to the archivist of the United States as AOTIS, and with the help of the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, we had received an emergency grant of $25,000, which allowed us to rent a freezer truck on the coast. This was wonderful because we did not have to transport the records back to Jackson to be frozen. 4 hours in a minivan with moldy records is no picnic for the nose. And other institutions on the coast could also access the freezer without us being there. Throughout all this time, we were having some frustrating discussions with FEMA about those records that were not government records, but were records of local historical societies and similar organizations that were at risk. Private, not-for-profit organizations are instructed to go to the Small Business Administration and apply for a loan. Should SBA not loan them the money, they were then to return to FEMA to see if FEMA could provide any assistance. For many local groups, their operation is less than a shoestring one. Generally, there are no funds for staff. They are all volunteer organizations with essentially no income. SBA wouldn't lend to them. We were frustrated that they had to go through this bureaucratic process only to be turned down while the records were remaining at risk. At last, we were able to reach agreement that the goal was really to protect the community's vital records, and the vitalness of the records could not be determined until the records were stabilized. Having reached this goal, it opened the door for us to ship all of the records to a disaster recovery company for freeze drying. I think the program said lessons we learned. I have to say lessons we are still learning because we're still digesting all of this work and experience. But here are a few points I'd like to share with you this morning. First one is to invert an old adage, there is something new under the sun. If Katrina did not throw the known rules out the window, she certainly changed them so that many additional ones will be needed to prepare us to respond to a catastrophe of similar proportions. Plan for a total meltdown. That is what we experienced on the Gulf Coast for an extended period of time. What we considered some of the vital necessities for life were either non-existent or in extremely scarce supply. Water, food, electricity, gas, lodging. Those people living on the site could not cope with the issue of records preservation. Those of us far enough away to be able to cope had to plan for the lack of vitals as we went in. Not just the vitals, but all the recovery supplies we would need, including water for cleaning, had to be gathered. That work in itself consumed valuable response time. Identify your response role. Because the Mississippi Department of Archives and History is a comprehensive historical agency, we were concerned with both government and private records. As we got into the thick of things, retrieving the records and removing them far from the scene, our first thought was stabilize the records. The problems encountered with assisting private, not-for-profit organizations have already been mentioned, so we initially concentrated on stabilizing local government records. Once that was done, we realized that the municipalities had no place to return the records, they had no staff to use the records, and in some cases, they actually had few citizens to want to use the records. In effect, we were about to become the records program for the municipalities. We became the agent for the municipalities in arranging for the freeze-drying and cleaning of the records, and we're still wrestling with the problems of where they will go when returned. Past Christiane, for example, lost every tax-paying business within the borders of its city. Its tax base was essentially eliminated, and that town is now living on loans and in hopes of not going bankrupt. In defining our response, our thinking is evolving along these lines. The department's role is to assist local government in stabilizing the vital records. If necessary, the storage of and access to the records will become the sole responsibility of the department. Working with the Mississippi Emergency Management Agency, we now have authority to go in as soon as possible to initiate the stabilization work, even in, as in the case last year, while first responders are still active. Once the records are stabilized, we withdraw from the scene and begin the work to have the records available once the community is able to use them again. Prepare your staff for the work ahead, not only training them in adequate records handling procedures, but in preparing them to deal with the psychological and physical effects of such work. As I have said, staff were driving 4 hours to the coast, working 8 to 10 hours, and driving 4 hours back. Physical exhaustion under these circumstances came easily. Working in an environment of near total devastation brought on early mental fatigue. The offers of assistance from many of you could not be taken up because of logistics. There was no place to house those who wanted to come in to help. Educate your staff ahead of time about the dangers, as well as the non-dangers of working with mold and mildew. Provide adequate uniforms for them. Inform them about vaccinations and other health issues. The anxiety level would be much lower if you're able to do this. Something that seems perhaps small, but it loomed big for us. Arrange for emergency cash funding for staff. Discretionary cash is rare enough in government circles in normal times, but when you are in a situation where all the banks are closed, no electricity, and no communication lines prevent credit card usage, cash is required. In our situation, when staff was making repeated trips day after day, the need for emergency cash became acute. Let me say here that the quick action of the Archivist of the United States and the National Historical Publications Records Commission in providing an emergency $25,000 grant was of immense help to us. While it was not cash on hand, the grant did give us a cushion of resources that we could use to commit to certain recovery actions, such as renting the freezer truck on the coast. The cushion was essential at the time because then we had no assurance that reimbursement would be forthcoming from FEMA. Thank you very much, Aeldis. Work with your peers in other states to coordinate emergency assistance. And I repeat what the Archivist of the United States said earlier. We were truly overwhelmed by the offers of assistance from many of you and from others across the country. And so we truly wanted to take advantage of your offers. But as I have said, we were in a state of near total meltdown, and we could not handle the logistics of bringing you in. With the exodus of coast residents across the state, there were no hotel rooms available, even in Jackson, 150 miles to the north, for months. At times, we felt that we were offending those offering their aid because we were declining the offers. But there was just no way to respond to such generosity during that time. When the situation had settled some, we were able to welcome a visit by representatives of COSA, SAA, and the National Emergency Task Force, and to give them an on-site overview of the situation. We were grateful for the opportunity for them to see the conditions in which we were working. Let me again say a special word of thanks to the Archivist of the United States for his support he offered in Flora. Not only did he provide emergency grant resources and staff resources for the seminar on mold, in November he came to Mississippi and Louisiana and toured the area, visiting with local records keepers. While in Jackson, he met with state emergency agency leadership, a meeting that was invaluably helpful in ultimately finding the help we did for the local historical society records. I close with this Katrina image. In my imagination, she is a benevolent creature who has planted herself on the shore to tell future hurricanes to stay away. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weinstein and Hank. We have some time to take a few questions, and they've both agreed to answer any questions that you may have.
The same people who nominated me for this job have provided this year the largest budget in NARA's history, number one. Number two, we have extraordinarily good relations with members and leadership of Congress, both parties, both houses, and with the administration at all levels. Everybody has... Uh, their particular, I won't say obsessions, but their particular concerns. I'm in the process of trying to persuade those within the administration who have not been necessarily supportive of NHPRC, not because they are opposed to the policy, but because they felt that there are other agencies doing the same work. Was it a duplication issue? I'm continuing my efforts, my missionary efforts, if you will, to convert people to what I would consider to be a more balanced view of the functions of NHPRC. So we have no enemies, and I would reject the notion that, or no adversaries. We have a degree of support that I'm very grateful for in all quarters. I wanted to say two things, as long as I'm at the microphone. In connection with that, first of all, I've been searching for ways of cloning Hank, and finding. But this man basically has developed the rules of the road as he went forward, with no resources. I mean, no resources. And I'm sorry. We have to thank Hank once more because he's taught us all a good lesson. But two lessons that Hank did not mention, I'm going to mention now briefly. Well, you did mention the emergency cash issue. That's an important one. I found out to my own chagrin when I got to the archives the morning after the flood. There, as dawn went up, the folks have been working all night long. And I'm the son of people who owned a delicatessen restaurant, so I grew up in the food business. And it didn't occur to me until rather late that morning. They said, has anybody eaten around here all day? And the answer was essentially that nobody had eaten. They'd been working since 1, 2 in the morning and just going at it. So there were 7, 8 o'clock, and nobody had a bite to eat, a little bit of coffee around, but not that much. And it suddenly occurred to me that I wasn't doing anybody any good here at all, except I just reached in my pocket. I took whatever spare cash I had. And I suggested people go out and get some Popeye's chicken. They needed all the fat they could get. They're going to continue working, and that worked. That turned out to be a kind of symbolic turning point. And people talked about the Popeye's chicken for the next few days as they worked. It was great. So that's a lesson for state archivists if you have an emergency in your state. Turn to the Popeye's chicken. Secondly, politics, politicians, leaders, our leaders. What Hank did not mention is that when all this was over, he and I paid a visit to Senator Thad Cochran of his home state, who couldn't have been more supportive of what we were trying to do, but who didn't have an inclination of the complexity of what Hank had been trying to do. And it was Hank's being able to sit there and explain what we had been through, what he had been through, that led to, I think, a much more responsive attitude on Senator Cochran's part, and he's a very powerful appropriator. And the fact of the matter is the Congress is going home, is home already. They're going to be in your home states and localities until September, then they'll be back in Washington for a month, then back again. If you have experiences that you want to share with your members of Congress or with the administration, share them. Share them. I'll repeat again, how many archivists does it take to change a policy? Everybody in this room. I'll stop there.
And we have a question over here. Okay, the question was, what are some good sources for training people on how to deal with mold?
I don't have a bibliographical sheet in front of me, but I would refer to you first. The source that we used initially was the National Archives and Records Administration. What we were finding both, I'm not answering your question specifically because I do not have specific sources on my brain, but I would like to say what we were finding on the news, the television news, were some horror stories citing some people who probably should know what they were talking about, but it was there was a lot of journalism that didn't really set well during that time because it was alarmist. The internet was full of horror stories, and at that point, our staff really, some of them really didn't know what to believe. So that's where the assistance offered by National Archives, that's where we got our initial training. And then we referred also to our state epidemiologist, who was very helpful. That would be a source that should be close at hand for you.
Is Vicki Walsh here? Vicki? In the COSA booth. Well, you're here, David. Stand up. Talk about the toolkit. Come on up and tell us a little bit about the 50 state plans and the toolkit and the rest. I think some of you know David Carmichael here. David, do you know some of these people?
Couple of them.
Okay.
I'm not dressed for this. I'm sorry. COSA project on emergency preparedness that we've done with great help from the National Archives, from our friends at SAA and NAGARA, is a three-pronged approach. The first was to prepare an assessment of the state archives' readiness for an emergency, and we have almost 50 of the 56 states and territories in. The second was to prepare a prep document that we could carry with us so that at the moment of emergency we have the vital information there. But the third part that is coming up next is to develop a toolkit that will be online to assist during an emergency, because what we did hear from Hank and from others was that when you're in the middle of the disaster, that is not the time to be sorting through all the bibliographies to figure out which one of these is the most important one I need right this moment. And so we're working with a lot of organizations, Heritage Preservation among them, and Northeast Document Conservation Center, and many other people, to try to identify the key resources, put them into a toolkit, and make them available through the web so that when you're up to your neck in alligators, you can zero in on the proper one. So.
Okay, we'd like to thank you all for coming again this morning, and again thank our two speakers, Dr. Weinstein and Hank Holmes, and thank you for another wonderful plenary.